unique circumstances. I know he can be very charming, Vasily said. But you should know that he's also very deceptive and very clever. That's certainly true, I thought, but all I said was, he has an unusual mind, Vasily chortled. What a diplomat you've become! You've a most refreshing way about you. Given time, I have no doubt that despite your humble antecedents, you will learn to conduct yourself with the restraint and elegance of a noblewoman. You mean, I'll learn to shut up? Vasily gave a disapproving sniff. I needed to get out of this conversation before I really offended him. Vasily might seem a fool, but he was still a prince. Indeed, no, he said with a stilted laugh. You have a delightful canter. Thank you, I mumbled. If you'll excuse me, Your Highness. Vasily stepped into my path. I don't know what arrangements you've made with my brother, but you must realize that he is a second son. Whatever his ambitions, that's all he ever will be. Only I can make you queen. There it was. I heaved an internal sigh. Only a king can make a queen, I reminded him. Vasily waved this talk away. My father won't live much longer. I as good as rule, Ravkanau. Is that what you call it? I thought with a surge of irritation. I doubted Vasily would even be in Osalta if Nikolai didn't present a threat to his crown. But this time I held my tongue. You've risen high for a Karemzin orphan, he went on. But you might rise higher still. I can assure you, Moy Tsarevich, I said with complete honesty. I have no such ambitions.
And what do you want, Sun Summoner?
Right now? I'd like to go have my lunch. His lower lip jutted out sulkily, and for a moment he looked just like his father. Then he smiled.
You're a smart girl, he said, and I think you'll prove a useful one. I look forward to deepening our acquaintance.
I would like nothing better, I lied. He took my hand and pressed his moist mouth to my knuckles.
Until then, Alina Starkov.
I stifled a gag. As he strode off, I wiped my hand surreptitiously on my kefta. Mal was waiting for me at the edge of the woods.
What was that about? He asked, his face worried.
Oh, you know, I replied. Another prince, another proposal.
You can't be serious,
Mal said with a disbelieving laugh.
He doesn't waste any time.
Power is alliance, I intoned, imitating Nikolai.
Should I offer my felicitations?
Mal asked, but there was no edge to his voice, only amusement. Apparently the heir to the throne of Ravka wasn't quite as threatening as an overconfident privateer. Do you think the Darkling had to deal with unwanted advances from wet-lipped royals? I asked glumly. Mal snickered. What's so funny?
I just pictured the Darkling being cornered by a sweaty duchess trying to have her way with him.
I snorted and then I started to laugh outright. Nikolai and Vasily were so different, it was hard to believe they shared any blood at all. Unbidden, I remembered Nikolai's kiss, the rough feel of his mouth on mine as he held me to him. I shook my head. They may be different, I reminded myself as we headed into the palace. But they both want to use you just the same. Chapter 17 Summer deepened, bringing waves of balmy heat to Osalta. The only relief was to be found in the lake, or in the cold pools of the banya that lay in the dark shade of a birchwood grove beside the little palace.
Whatever hostility the Rovkin court felt toward the Grisha, it didn't stop them from beckoning squallers and tide-makers to the Grand Palace to summon breezes and fashion massive blocks of ice to cool the stuffy rooms. It was hardly a worthy use of Grisha talent, but I was eager to keep the king and queen happy, and I'd already deprived them of several much-valued fabricators who were hard at work on David's mysterious mirrored dishes. Every morning I met with my Grisha council, sometimes for a few minutes, sometimes for hours, to discuss intelligence reports, troop movements, and what we were hearing from the northern and southern borders. Nikolai still hoped to take the fight to the Darkling before he'd assembled the full strength of his shadow army, but so far Ravka's network of spies and informants had been unable to discover his location. It was looking more and more likely that we'd have to make our stand in Os Ulta. Our only advantage was that the Darkling couldn't simply send the Nietzsche Voya against us. He had to stay close to his creatures, and that meant he would have to march to the capital with them. The big question was whether he would enter Ravka from Fjerda or from the Shuhan. Standing in the war room before the Grisha Council, Nikolai gestured to one of the massive maps along the wall.
"We took back most of this territory in the last campaign," he said, pointing to Ravka's northern border with Fjerda. "It's dense forest, almost impossible to cross when the rivers aren't frozen, and all the access roads have been blockaded."
"Are there Grisha stationed there?" asked Zoya.
"No," Nikolai said. "But there are lots of scouts based out of Ulensk. If he comes that way, we'll have plenty of warning."
"And he would have to deal with the Petrozoi," said Pasha. "Whether he goes over or around them, it will buy us more time."
She'd come into her own over the last few weeks. Though David remained silent and fidgety, she actually seemed glad to have time away from the workrooms.
"I'm more concerned with the permafrost," Nikolai said, running his hand along the stretch of border that ran above Tsubea. "It's heavily fortified, but that's a lot of territory to cover."
I nodded. Mal and I had once walked those wild lands together, and I remembered how vast they felt. I caught myself looking around the room, seeking him out, even though I knew he'd gone on another hunt, this time with a group of Kerch marksmen and Ravkin diplomats.
"And if he comes from the south?" asked Zoya.
Nikolai signaled Fedor, who rose and began to walk the Grisha through the weak points of the southern border. Because he'd been stationed in Sikorsk, the Korporalnik knew the area well.
"It's almost impossible to patrol all the mountain passes coming out of the Sikorzoi," he observed grimly. "Shoe raiding parties have been taking advantage of that fact for years. It would be easy enough for the Darkling to slip through."
"Then it's a straight march to Os Ulta," said Sergei.
"Past the military base at Politsnaya," Nikolai noted. "That could work to our advantage. Either way, when he marches, we'll be ready."
"Ready?" Pavel snorted. "For an army of indestructible monsters?"
"They're not indestructible," Nikolai said, nodding to me. "And the Darkling isn't either. I know. I shot him."
Zoya's eyes widened.
"You shot him?"
"Yes," he said. "Unfortunately, I didn't do a very good job of it, but I'm sure I'll improve with practice."
He surveyed the Grisha, looking into each worried face before he spoke again.
"The Darkling is powerful, but so are we. He's never faced the might of the First and Second Armies working in tandem, or the kinds of weapons I intend to supply. We face him. We flank him. We see which bullet gets lucky."
While the Darkling's shadow horde was focused on the little palace, he would be vulnerable. Small, heavily armed units of Grisha and soldiers would be stationed at 2-mile intervals around the capital. Once the fighting began, they would close on the Darkling and unleash all the firepower that Nikolai could muster. In a way, it was what the Darkling had always feared. Again, I remembered how he'd described the new weaponry being created by Ravka's borders, and what he'd said to me so long ago beneath the caved-in roof of an old barn. The age of Grisha power is coming to an end. Paja cleared her throat.
Do we know what happens to the Shadow Soldiers when we kill the Darkling?
I wanted to hug her. I didn't know what might happen to the Nichevoya if we managed to put the Darkling down. They might banish to nothing, or they might go into a mad frenzy, or worse.
But she'd said it. When we kill the Darkling. Tentative, frightened, but it still sounded suspiciously like hope.
We focused the majority of our efforts on Osalta's defense. The city had an ancient system of warning bells to alert the palace when an enemy was in sight. With his father's permission, Nikolai had installed heavy guns, like those on the Hummingbird above the city and palace walls. Despite Grisha grumbling, I'd had several placed on the roof of the little palace. They might not stop the Nichevoya, but they would slow them down. Tentatively, the other Grisha had begun to open up to the value of the fabricators. With the help from the Inferni, the Materialkai were trying to create Granatki that might produce a powerful enough flash of light to stall or stun the Shadow Soldiers. The problem was doing it without using blasting powders that would level everyone and everything around them. I sometimes worried that they might blow up the entire little palace and do the Darkling's work for him. More than once, I saw Grisha in the dining hall with burnt cuffs or singed brows. I encouraged them to try the more dangerous work by the lakeside with tide makers on hand in case of emergency. Nikolai was intrigued enough by the project that he insisted on getting involved in the design. The fabricators tried to ignore him, then pretended to indulge him, but they quickly learned that Nikolai was more than a bored prince who liked to dabble. Not only did he understand David's ideas, he'd worked long enough with the rogue Grisha that he slipped easily into the language of the small science. Soon they seemed to forget his rank and his Otkazatsia status, and he could often be found hunched over a table in the Materialkai workshops. I was most disturbed by the experiments taking place behind the red lacquer doors of the Corporalkai anatomy rooms, where they were collaborating with the fabricators to try to fuse Grisha steel with human bone. The idea was to make it possible for a soldier to withstand Nichevoya attack. But the process was painful and imperfect, and often the metal was simply rejected by the subject's body. The healers did what they could, but the ragged screams of First Army volunteers could sometimes be heard echoing through the halls of the little palace. Afternoons were taken up by endless meetings at the Grand Palace. The Sun Summoner's power was a valuable bartering chip in Ravka's attempts to forge alliances with other countries, and I was frequently asked to put in appearances at diplomatic gatherings to demonstrate my power and prove that I was, in fact, alive. The Queen hosted teas and dinners where I was paraded out to perform. Nikolai often dropped by to dole out compliments, flirt shamelessly, and hover protectively by my chair, like a doting suitor. But nothing was as tedious as the strategy sessions with the King's advisors and commanders. The King rarely attended. He preferred to spend his days hobbling after serving maids and sleeping in the sun, like an old tomcat. In his absence, his counselors talked in endless circles. They argued that we should make peace with the Darkling, or that we should go to war with the Darkling. They argued for allying with the Shu, then for partnering with Fyarda. They argued every line of every budget, from quantities of ammunition to what the troops ate for breakfast, and yet it was rare that anything got done or decided. When Vasily learned that Nikolai and I were attending the meetings, he put aside years of ignoring his duties as the Lansov heir and insisted on being there as well. To my surprise, Nikolai welcomed him enthusiastically.
"What a relief," he said. "Please tell me you can make sense of these."
He shoved towering stacks of ledgers across the table.
"What is this?"
Vasily asked.
"A proposal for repairs to an aqueduct outside of Chernistin." "All this for an aqueduct?"
"Don't worry," said Nikolai. "I'll have the rest delivered to your room."
"There's more? Get one of the ministers."
"You saw what happened when our father let others take over the business of ruling Ravka. We must remain vigilant." Warily, Vasily lifted the topmost paper from the pile, as if he were picking up a soiled rag. It took everything in me not to burst out laughing.
"Vasily thinks he can lead as our father did,"
Nikolai confided to me later that afternoon.
"Throwing banquets, giving the occasional speech. I'm going to make sure he knows just what it means to rule without the Darkling or the apparat there to take the reins."
It seemed like a good enough plan, but before long, I was cursing both princes beneath my breath. Vasily's presence ensured that meetings ran twice as long. He postured and preened, weighed in on every issue, held forth at length on patriotism, strategy, and the finer points of diplomacy.
"I've never met a man who can say so much without saying anything at all," I fumed as Nikolai walked me back to the little palace after a particularly wretched session. "There's got to be something you can do."
"Like what?"
"Get one of his prize ponies to kick him in the head."
"I'm sure they're frequently tempted," Nikolai said.
"Vasily's lazy and vain, and he likes to take shortcuts. But there's no easy way to govern a country. Trust me, he'll tire of it all soon enough."
"Maybe," I said.
"But I'll probably die of boredom before he does."
Nikolai laughed.
"Next time, bring a flask. Every time he changes his mind, take a sip."
I groaned.
"I'd be passed out on the floor before the hour was up."
With Nikolai's help, I'd brought in armaments experts from Politsnaya to help familiar the Grisha with modern weaponry and give them training in firearms. Though the sessions had started out tensely, they seemed to be going more smoothly now, and we hoped that a few friendships might be forming between the First and Second Armies. The units of Grisha and soldiers who had been assembled to hunt down the Darkling when he approached Ols Alta made the fastest progress. They returned from training missions full of private jokes and new camaraderie. They even took to calling each other Nolniki, Zeros, because they were no longer strictly First or Second Army. I'd been worried about how Botkin might respond to all the changes, but the man seemed to have a gift for killing, no matter the method, and he delighted in any excuse to spend time talking weaponry with Tolya and Tamar. Because the Shu had a bad habit of taking a scalpel to their Grisha, few survived to make it into the ranks of the Second Army. Botkin loved being able to speak in his native tongue, but he also loved the twins' ferocity. They didn't rely only on their Corporal Kai abilities the way Grisha raised at the Little Palace tended to. Instead, heartrending was just one more weapon in their impressive arsenal.
"Dangerous boy. Dangerous girl," Botkin commented.
Watching the twins spar with a group of Corporal Kai one morning, while a clutch of nervous summoners waited their turn. Marie and Sergei were there, Nadia trailing behind them as always.
"She's worse than he is," complained Sergei.
Tamar had split his lip open and he was having trouble talking.
"I feel sorry for her husband."
"We'll not marry," said Botkin,
as Tamar threw a hapless Inferni to the ground.
"Why not?"
I asked, surprised.
"Not her. Not brother either," said the mercenary. "They are like Botkin, born for battle, made for war."
Three corporalki hurled themselves at Tolia. In moments, they were all moaning on the floor. I thought of what Tolia had said in the library, that he wasn't born to serve the Darkling. Like so many Shu, he'd taken the path of the soldier for hire, traveling the world as a mercenary and a privateer. But he'd ended up at the little palace anyway. How long would he and his sister stay?
I like her, said Nadia, looking wistfully at Tamar. She's fearless.
Botkin laughed.
Fearless is other word for stupid.
I wouldn't say that to her face,
grumbled Sergei, as Marie dabbed his lip with a damp cloth. I found myself starting to smile and turned aside. I hadn't forgotten the way the three of them had welcomed me to the little palace. They hadn't been the ones to call me a whore or try to throw me out, but they certainly hadn't spoken up to defend me. And the idea of pretending friendship was just a little too much. Besides, I didn't quite know how to behave around them. We'd never been truly close, and now our difference in status felt like an unbridgeable gap. Jenya wouldn't care, I thought suddenly. Jenya had known me. She'd laughed with me and confided in me, and no shiny kefta or title would have kept her from telling me exactly what she thought, or slipping her arm through mine to share a bit of gossip. Despite the lies she'd told, I missed her. As if in answer to my thoughts, I felt a tug on my sleeve, and a tremulous voice said,
"My sovereigni."
Nadia stood shifting from foot to foot.
"I hoped..."
"What is it?" She turned to a murky corner of the stables and gestured to a young boy in Ethereal-Kai blue, whom I'd never seen before. A few Grisha had begun to trickle in after we'd sent out the pardon, but this boy looked too young to have served in the field. He approached nervously, fingers twisting in his kefta.
"This is Adric,"
Nadia said, placing her arm around him.
"My brother."
The resemblance was there, though you had to look for it.
"We heard that you plan to evacuate the school."
"That's right." I was sending the students to the one place I knew with dormitories and space enough to house them, a place far from the fighting. Keremzin. Botkin would go with them, too. I hated to lose such a capable soldier, but this way the younger Grisha would still be able to learn from him, and he'd be able to keep an eye on them. Since Bagra wouldn't see me, I'd sent a servant to her with the same offer. She had made no reply. Despite my best attempts to ignore her slights, the repeated rejection still stung. "You're a student?" I asked Adric, pushing thoughts of Bagra from my mind. He nodded once, and I noted the determined thrust to his chin.
"Adric was wondering. We were wondering if..."
"I want to stay,"
he said fiercely. My brows shot up. "How old are you?"
"Old enough to fight."
"He would have graduated this year," put in Nadia.
I frowned. He was only a couple of years younger than I was, but he was all bony elbows and rumpled hair.
"Go with the others to Keremzin," I said. "If you still want to, you can join us in a year."
"If we're still here."
"I'm good,"
he said.
"I'm a squaller, and I'm as strong as Nadia, even without an amplifier."
"It's too dangerous."
"This is my home. I'm not leaving."
"Adric,"
Nadia chastised.
"It's okay," I said.
Adric seemed almost feverish. His hands were balled into fists. I looked at Nadia.
"You're sure you want him to stay?"
"I..."
began Adric.
"I'm talking to your sister. If you fall to the Darkling's army, she's the one who will have to mourn you."
Nadia paled slightly at that, but Adric didn't flinch. I had to admit he had mettle. Nadia worried the inside of her lip, glancing from me to Adric.
"If you're afraid to disappoint him, think what it will be like to bury him," I said.
I knew I was being harsh, but I wanted them both to understand what they were asking. She hesitated, then straightened her shoulders.
Let him fight, she said. I say he stays. If you send him away, he'll just be back at the gates a week from now.
I sighed, then turned my attention back to Adric, who was already grinning.
Not a word to the other students, I said. I don't want them getting ideas.
I jabbed a finger at Nadia.
And he's your responsibility.
Thank you, moi sovereigni, said
Adric, bowing so low I thought he might tip over. I was already regretting my decision.
Get him back to classes.
I watched them walk up the hill toward the lake, then dusted myself off and made my way to one of the smaller training rooms, where I found Mal sparring with Pavel. Mal had been at the little palace less and less lately. The invitations had started arriving the afternoon he returned from Balakirev. Hunts, house parties, trout fishing, card games. Every nobleman and officer seemed to want Mal at his next event. Sometimes he was just gone for an afternoon, sometimes for a few days. It reminded me of being back at Keremsen, when I would watch him ride away and then wait each day at the kitchen window for him to return. But if I was honest with myself, the days when he was gone were almost easier. When he was at the little palace, I felt guilty for not being able to spend more time with him, and I hated the way the Grisha ignored him or talked down to him like a servant. As much as I missed him, I encouraged him to go. It's better this way, I told myself. Before he deserted to help me, Mal had been a tracker with a bright future, surrounded by friends and admirers. He didn't belong standing guard in doorways or lurking at the edges of rooms, playing the role of my dutiful shadow as I went from one meeting to the next.
I could watch him all day, said a voice behind me.
I stiffened. Zoya was standing there. Even in the heat, she never seemed to sweat.
You don't think he stinks of Keremsen? I asked, remembering the vicious words she had once spoken to me. I find the lower classes have a certain rough appeal. You will let me know when you're through with him, won't you?
I beg your pardon?
Oh, did I misunderstand? You two seem so close. But I'm sure you're setting your sights higher these days.
I turned on her.
What are you doing here, Zoya?
I came for a training session.
You know what I mean. What are you doing at the little palace?
I'm a soldier of the Second Army. This is where I belong.
I folded my arms. It was time Zoya and I had this out.
You don't like me, and you've never missed an opportunity to let me know it. Why follow me now?
What choice do I have?
I'm sure the Darkling would gladly welcome you back at his side.
Are you ordering me to leave?
She was striving for her usual haughty tone, but I could tell she was scared. It gave me a guilty little thrill.
I want to know why you're so determined to stay.
Because I don't want to live in darkness, she said.
Because you're our best chance.
I shook my head. Too easy. She flushed.
Am I supposed to beg?
Would she? I found I didn't mind the idea.
You're vain. You're ambitious. You would have done anything for the Darkling's attention. What changed?
What changed?
She choked out. Her lips thinned and her fists clenched at her sides.
I had an aunt who lived in Novokrybirsk. A niece. The Darkling could have told me what he meant to do, if I could have warned them.
Her voice broke, and I was instantly ashamed of the pleasure I'd felt at watching her squirm. Bagra's voice echoed in my ears. You're taking to power well. As it grows, it will hunger for more. And yet, did I believe Zoya? Was the sheen in her eyes real or pretense? She blinked her tears back and glared at me.
I still don't like you, Starkov. I never will. You're common and clumsy. And I don't know why you were born with such power. But you're the Sun Summoner, and if you can keep Ravka free, then I'll fight for you.
I watched her, considering, noting the two bright spots of color that flamed high on her cheeks, the trembling of her lip.
Well,
she said, and I could see how much it cost her to ask.
Are you sending me away?
I waited a moment longer.
You can stay, I said.
For now.
Is everything all right?
Mal asked. We hadn't even noticed that he'd left off sparring. In an instant, Zoya's uncertainty was gone. She gave him a dazzling smile.
I hear you're quite the marvel with a bow and arrow. I thought you might offer me a lesson.
Mal glanced from Zoya back to me.
Maybe later.
I'll look forward to it, she said, and swept away in a soft rustle of silk.
What was that about? He asked, as we began the walk up the hill to the little palace. I don't trust her. For a long minute he said nothing.
Alina, Mal began uneasily. What happened in Krybirsk?
I cut him off quickly. I didn't want to know what he might have done with Zoya back at the Grisha camp.
And that was hardly the point.
She was one of the Darkling's favorites, and she's always hated me.
She was probably jealous of you.
She broke two of my ribs.
She... what?
It was an accident. Sort of. I'd never told Mal exactly how bad it had been for me before I'd learned to use my power. The endless lonely days of failure. I just can't be sure where her real allegiance lies. I rubbed the back of my neck where the muscles had started to bunch. I can't be sure of anyone. Not the Grisha, not the servants. Any of them could be working for the Darkling. Mal looked around. For once, nobody seemed to be watching. Impulsively, he seized hold of my hand.
Gritsky's throwing a fortune-telling party in the upper town, 2 days from now. Come with me.
Gritsky?
His father is Stepan Gritsky,
the Pickle King.
New money,
Mal said in a very good imitation of a smug noble.
But his family has a palace down by the canal.
I can't, I said, thinking of the meetings, David's mirrored dishes, the evacuation of the school. It just felt wrong to go to a party where we could be at war in a matter of days or weeks.
You can, said Mal.
Just for an hour or two. It was so tempting to steal a few moments with Mal away from the pressures of the little palace. He must have sensed that I was wavering.
We'll dress you up as one of the performers, he said. No one will even know the Sun Summoner is there.
A party. Late in the evening, after the day's work was done. I'd miss one night of futile searching through the library. What was the harm in that?
All right, I said.
Let's go. His face broke into a grin that left me breathless. I didn't know if I'd ever get used to the idea that a smile like that might actually be for me.
Tolia and Tamar won't like it, he warned.
They're my guards. They follow my orders. Mal snapped to attention and swept me an elaborate bow.
Da, moi sovereigne,
he pronounced in somber tones.
We live to serve.
I rolled my eyes, but as I hurried to the Materialkai workrooms, I felt lighter than I had in weeks. Chapter 18. The Gritsky Mansion was in the Canal District, considered the least fashionable part of the upper town because of its proximity to the bridge and the rabble across it. It was a lavish little building, bordered by a war memorial on one side and the gardens of the convent of Sancta Lisabetta on the other. Mal had managed to secure a borrowed coach for the evening, and we were tucked inside its narrow confines with a very cranky Tamar. She and Tolia had grumbled long and loudly about the party, but I'd made it clear that I wasn't going to budge. I also swore them to secrecy. I didn't want word of my little excursion beyond the palace gates to reach Nikolai. We were all dressed in the style of Suli fortune-tellers, in vibrant orange silk cloaks and red lacquered masks, carved to resemble jackals. Tolia had remained behind. Even covered head to toe, his size would draw too much attention. Mal squeezed my hand, and I felt a surge of giddy excitement. My cloak was uncomfortably warm, and my face was already starting to itch beneath the mask, but I didn't care. I felt like we were back at Keremsen, casting off our chores and braving the threat of the switch, just to sneak away to our meadow. We would lie in the cool grass and listen to the hum of the insects, watch the clouds break apart overhead. That kind of peace seemed so far away now. The street leading to the Pickle King's mansion was clogged with carriages. We turned onto an alley near the convent, so we'd be better able to mix in with the performers at the servants' entrance. Tamar carefully shifted her cloak as we descended from the coach. She and Mal were both carrying hidden pistols, and I knew that beneath all the orange silk, she had her twin axes strapped to each thigh.
"What if someone actually wants his fortune told?" I asked, tightening the laces of my mask and pulling my hood up.
"Just feed him the usual drivel," said Mal. "Beautiful women, unexpected wealth. Beware the number 8.
The servants' entrance led past a steam-filled kitchen and into the house's back rooms. But as soon as we stepped inside, a man dressed in what must have been the Gritsky livery seized my arm.
"Just what do you think you're doing?" he said, giving me a shake. I saw Tamar's hands go to her hip. You three should already be circulating.
He shoved us toward the main rooms of the house.
"Don't spend too long with any single guest, and don't let me catch you drinking."
I nodded, trying to get my heart to stop hammering, and we hurried into the ballroom. The Pickle King had spared no expense. The mansion had been decorated to look like the most decadent Suli camp imaginable. The ceiling was hung with 1,000 star-shaped lanterns. Silk-covered wagons were parked around the edges of the room in a glittering caravan, and fake bonfires glowed with dancing, colored light. The terrace doors had been thrown open, and the night air hummed with the rhythmic clang of finger cymbals and the wail of violins. I saw the real-life Suli fortune-tellers scattered throughout the crowd and realized what an eerie sight we must make in our jackal masks. But the guests didn't seem to mind. Most of them were already well in their cups, laughing and shouting to one another in boisterous groups, gawking at the acrobats twirling from silk swings overhead. Some sat swaying in their chairs, having their fortunes told over golden urns of coffee. Others ate at the long table that had been set up on the terrace, gorging on stuffed figs and bowls of pomegranate seeds, clapping along with the music. Mal snuck me a little glass of kvass, and we found a bench in a shadowy corner of the terrace while Tamar took up her post, a discreet distance away. I rested my head against Mal's shoulder, happy just to be sitting beside him, listening to the thump and jangle of the music. The air was heavy with the scent of some night-blooming flower, and beneath that, the tang of lemons. I breathed deeply, feeling some of the exhaustion and fear of the last few weeks ease away. I wriggled my foot from my slipper and let my toes dig into the cool gravel. Mal adjusted his hood to better hide his face and tipped up his mask, then reached forward and did the same with mine. He leaned in. Our jackal masks bumped snouts. I started to laugh.
"Next time, different costumes," he grumbled.
"Bigger hats?"
"Maybe we could just wear baskets over our heads."
Two girls came swaying up to us. Tamar was by my side in an instant. We pushed our masks back into place.
"Tell our fortunes,"
the taller girl demanded, practically toppling over her friend. Tamar shook her head, but Mal gestured to one of the little tables, laid with blue enamel cups and a golden urn. The girl squealed and poured out a tiny amount of sludge-like coffee. The Suli told fortunes by reading the dregs at the bottom of the cup. She downed the coffee and grimaced. I elbowed Mal in the side. "Now what?" He rose and walked to the table. He said, peering into the cup. The girl seized his arm.
"What is it?"
He waved me over. I gritted my teeth and bent over the cup.
"Is it bad?"
the girl moaned.
"It is good,"
said Mal in the most outrageous Suli accent I had ever heard. The girl sighed in relief.
"You will meet a handsome stranger."
The girls giggled and clapped their hands. I couldn't resist.
"He will be very wicked man," I interjected.
My accent was even worse than Mal's. If any real Suli overheard me, I'd probably end up with a black eye.
"You must run from this man."
"Oh,"
the girl sighed in disappointment.
"You must marry ugly man," I said. "Very fat."
I held my arms out in front of me, indicating a giant belly.
"He will make you happy."
I heard Mal snort beneath his mask. The girl sniffed.
"I don't like this fortune," she said. "Let's go try another one."
As they flounced away, two rather tipsy noblemen took their place. One had a beaky nose and wobbly jowls. The other threw back his coffee like he was gulping kvass and slammed the cup down on the table.
"Now,"
he slurred, twitching his bristly red mustache.
"What have I got in store? Make it good."
Mal pretended to study the cup.
"You will come into a great fortune." "Already have a great fortune. What else?"
Mal hedged.
"Your wife will bear you three handsome sons."
His beak-nosed companion burst out laughing.
"Then you'll know they aren't yours," he bellowed.
I thought the other nobleman would take offense, but instead he just guffawed, his red face turning even redder.
"They have to congratulate the footman," he roared. "I hear all the best families have bastards,"
chortled his friend.
"We all have dogs, too, but we don't let them sit at the table."
I grimaced beneath my mask. I had a sneaking suspicion they were talking about Nikolai.
"Oh, dear,"
I said, yanking the cup from Mal's hand.
"Oh, dear, so sad."
"What's that?"
said the nobleman, still laughing.
"You will go bald," I said. "Very bald."
He stopped laughing, and his meaty hand strayed to his already thinning red hair.
"And you,"
I said, pointing at his friend. Mal gave my foot a warning nudge, but I ignored him.
"You will catch the corpa."
"The what?"
"The corpa,"
I declared in dire tones.
"Your private parts will shrink to nothing."
He paled. His throat worked.
"But..."
At that moment, there was a shouting from inside the ballroom and a loud crash as someone upended a table. I saw two men shoving each other.
"I think it's time to leave," said Tamar, edging us away from the commotion.
I was about to protest when the fight broke out in earnest.
People started pushing and shoving, crowding the doors to the terrace. The music had stopped, and it looked like some of the fortune tellers had gotten into the scramble, too. Over the crowd, I saw one of the silken wagons collapse. Someone came hurtling toward us and crashed into the nobleman. The coffee urn toppled off the table, and the little blue cups followed.
"Let's go," said Mal, reaching for his pistol. "Out the back."
Tamar led the way, axes already in hand. I followed her down the stairs, but as we stepped off the terrace, I heard another horrible crash and a woman screaming. She was pinned beneath the banquet table.
Mal holstered his pistol. "Get her to the carriage," he shouted to Tamar. "I'll catch up."
"Mal!"
"Go! I'll be right behind you."
He pushed into the crowd toward the trapped woman. Tamar tugged me down the garden stairs and up a path that led back along the side of the mansion to the street. It was dark away from the glowing lanterns of the party. I let a soft light blossom to guide our steps.
"Don't," said Tamar. "This could be a distraction. You'll give away our location."
I let the light fade, and a second later I heard a scuffle, a loud oof, and then silence.
"Tamar?"
I looked back toward the party, hoping I would hear Mal's approach. My heart started to pound. I raised my hands. Forget giving away our location. I wasn't going to just stand around in the dark. Then I heard a gate creak, and strong hands took hold of me. I was yanked through the hedge. I sent light searing out in a hot flare. I was in a stone courtyard off the main garden, bordered on all sides by yew hedges, and I was not alone. I smelled him before I saw him. Turned earth, incense, mildew, the smell of a grave. I raised my hands as the apparat stepped out of the shadows. The priest was just as I remembered him, the same wiry black beard and relentless gaze. He still wore the brown robes of his station, but the king's double eagle was gone from his chest, replaced by a sunburst wrought in gold thread.
"Stay where you are," I warned.
He bowed low.
"Alina Starkov, soul Korolyeva. I mean you no harm."
"Where's Tamar? If she's been hurt..."
"Your guards will not be harmed, but I beg you to listen."
"What do you want? How did you know I would be here?"
"The faithful are everywhere, soul Korolyeva."
"Don't call me that."
"Every day, your holy army grows, drawn by the promise of your light. They wait only for you to lead them."
"My army? I've seen the pilgrims camped outside the city walls, poor, weak, hungry, all desperate for the scraps of hope you feed them."
"There are others, soldiers."
"More people who think I'm a saint because you've sold them a lie?"
"It is no lie, Alina Starkov. You are daughter of Karamzin, reborn of the fold."
"I didn't die," I said furiously. "I survived because I escaped the Darkling, and I murdered an entire skiff of soldiers and Grisha to do it. Do you tell your followers that?"
"Your people are suffering. Only you can bring about the dawn of a new age, an age consecrated in holy fire."
His eyes were wild, the black so deep I couldn't see his pupils. But was his madness real or part of some elaborate act?
"Just who will rule this new age?"
"You, of course. Sol Korolyeva, Sancta Alina."
"With you at my right hand? I read the book you gave me. Saints don't live long lives."
"Come with me, Alina Starkov."
"I'm not going anywhere with you."
"You are not yet strong enough to face the Darkling. I can change that."
I stilled.
Tell me what you know.
Join me, and all will be revealed.
I advanced on him, surprised by the throb of hunger and rage that shot through me. Where is the Firebird? I thought he might respond with confusion, that he might pretend ignorance. Instead, he smiled, his gums black, his teeth a crooked jumble. Tell me, priest, I ordered, or I'll cut you open right here, and your followers can try to pray you back together. With a start, I realized that I meant it. For the first time, he looked nervous. Good. Had he expected a tame saint? He held up his hands placatingly.
I do not know, he said. I swear it. But when the Darkling left the little palace, he did not realize it would be for the last time. He left many precious things behind, things others believed long since destroyed.
Another surge of hunger crackled through me.
Maritsova's journals?
You have them?
Come with me, Alina Starkov. There are secrets buried deep.
Could he possibly be telling the truth? Or would he just hand me over to the Darkling?
Alina!
Mal's voice sounded from somewhere on the other side of the hedge. I'm here, I called. Mal burst into the courtyard, pistol drawn. Tamar was right behind him. She'd lost one of her axes, and there was blood smeared over the front of her cloak. The apparat turned in a musty whirl of cloth and slipped between the bushes. Wait! I cried, already moving to follow. Tamar bolted past me with a furious roar, diving into the hedges to give chase.
I need him alive!
I shouted at her disappearing back.
Are you all right?
Mal panted as he came level with me. I took hold of his sleeve.
Mal, I think he has Moritzova's journals.
Did he hurt you?
I can handle an old priest, I said impatiently.
Did you hear what I said? He drew back.
Yes, I heard you. I thought you were in danger.
I wasn't, I... But Tamar was already striding back to us, her face a mask of frustration.
I don't understand it, she said, shaking her head. He was there, and then he was just gone.
Saints, I swore. She hung her head.
Forgive me.
I'd never seen her look so downcast.
It's all right, I said, my mind still churning.
Part of me wanted to go back down that alley and shout for the apparat, demand that he show himself, hunt him through the city streets until I found him, and pried the truth from his lying mouth. I peered down the row of hedges. I could still hear shouting from the party far behind me, and somewhere in the dark, the bells of the convent began to ring. I sighed. Let's get out of here. We found our driver waiting on the narrow side street where we'd left him. The ride back to the palace was tense.
That brawl was no coincidence, said Mal.
No, agreed Tamar, dabbing at the ugly cut on her chin.
He knew we would be there.
How? Mal demanded.
No one else knew we were going. Did you tell Nikolai?
Nikolai had nothing to do with this, I said.
How can you be so sure?
Because he has nothing to gain. I pressed my fingers to my temples. Maybe someone saw us leaving the palace.
How did the apparat get into Ols Alta without being seen? How did he even know we would be at that party?
I don't know, I replied wearily. He said, the faithful are everywhere. Maybe one of the servants overheard.
We got lucky tonight, said Tamar. This could have been much worse.
I was never in any real danger, I insisted. He just wanted to talk.
What did he say?
I gave her the barest description, but I didn't mention Moritzova's journals. I hadn't talked to anyone except Mal about them, and Tamar knew too much about the amplifiers already. He's raising some kind of army, I finished. People who believe that I've risen from the dead, who think I have some kind of holy power.
How many? Mal asked. I don't know. And I don't know what he intends to do with them. March them against the king? Send them to fight the Darkling's horde? I'm already responsible for the Grisha. I don't want the burden of an army of helpless Otkazatsia.
We're not all quite so feeble, said Mal, an edge to his voice.
I just meant he's using these people. He's exploiting their hope.
Is it any different than Nikolai parading you from village to village?
Nikolai isn't telling people that I'm immortal or can perform miracles.
No, Mal said. He's just letting them believe it.
Why are you so ready to attack him?
Why are you so quick to defend him?
I turned away, tired, exasperated, unable to think past the whir of thoughts in my head. The lamplit streets of the upper town slid by the coach's window. We passed the rest of the ride in silence. Back at the little palace, I changed clothes, while Mal and Tamar filled Tolia in on what had happened. I was sitting on the bed when Mal knocked. He shut the door behind him and leaned against it, looking around.
This room is so depressing. I thought you were going to redecorate.
I shrugged. I had too many other things to worry about, and I'd almost gotten used to the room's quiet gloom.
Do you believe he has the journals?
Mal asked. I was surprised he even knew they existed. He crossed to the bed, and I bent my knees to make room for him.
Tamar's right, he said, settling by my feet. That could have been much worse.
I sighed. So much for seeing the sights.
I shouldn't have suggested it.
I shouldn't have gone along with it. He nodded, scuffed the toe of his boot along the floor.
I miss you, he said quietly.
Soft words, but they sent a painful, welcome tremor through me. Had a part of me doubted it? He'd been gone so often. I touched his hand.
I miss you, too. Come to target practice with me tomorrow, he said, down by the lake.
I can't. Nikolai and I are meeting with a delegation of Kirch bankers. They want to see the Sun Summoner before they guarantee a loan to the crown.
Tell him you're sick.
Grisha don't get sick.
Well, tell him you're busy, he said.
I can't.
Other Grisha take time to—
I'm not other Grisha, I said, more harshly than I intended.
I know that, he said wearily.
He let out a long breath.
Saints! I hate this place!
I blinked, startled by the vehemence in his voice. You do?
I hate the parties. I hate the people. I hate everything about it.
I thought— You seemed not happy exactly, but—
I don't belong here, Alina. Don't tell me you haven't noticed.
That I didn't believe. Mal fit in everywhere.
Nikolai says everyone adores you. They're amused by me, Mal said. That's not the same thing.
He turned my hand over, tracing the scar that ran the length of my palm.
Do you know I actually miss being on the run? Even that filthy little boarding house in Coughton, and working in the warehouse. At least then I felt like I was doing something, not just wasting time and gathering gossip.
I shifted uncomfortably, feeling suddenly defensive.
You take every chance you get to be away. You don't have to accept every invitation.
He stared at me.
I stay away to protect you, Alina.
From what?
I asked incredulously. He stood up, pacing restlessly across the room.
What do you think people asked me on the royal hunt? The first thing! They wanted to know about me and you.
He turned on me, and when he spoke his voice was cruel, mocking.
Is it true that you're tumbling the Sun Summoner? What's it like with a saint? Does she have a taste for trackers? Or does she take all of her servants to her bed?
He crossed his arms.
I stay away to put distance between us, to stop the rumors. I probably shouldn't even be in here now.
I circled my knees with my arms, drawing them more tightly to my chest. My cheeks were burning.
Why didn't you say something?
What could